Session number 13265, reel number 24.
Mr. Marsden, reel 24.
So that the strip could be carved out of the coral and built, and the squadrons move in from, I guess, New Georgia and Mundra or wherever they were, and then we could go up and get our plant set up and work with them. I discovered from the orders we were given that we were supposed to be supplying breathing oxygen to all the islands forward, pretty well all the islands forward of Guadalcanal, which meant a fair number of fighter squadrons, apart from anything else. So came the day, and we were given seats aboard one of the NATS aircraft, Naval Air Transport Service. There were two airlines operating in the Pacific in those days. There were SCATS, Service Command Air Transport, and NATS, Naval Air Transport Service, mostly using DC-3s or C-47s or DACs, call them what you will, painted in dark olive green. A good old aeroplane. And we clambered aboard with our kit and took off and flew up the along Guadalcanal and out and over the islands. Offhand, I can't remember how long the flight was. An hour and a half, an hour and three quarters. I don't know. Quite interesting to look out and see wrecks here and there along the coast, and then to see the huge trail of islands all the way up, pass over an occasional airstrip with Curtiss P-40s and the odd Aero Cobras and whatnot. The Army were operating Aero Cobras, P-39s in this area. And so up to Vela, where the strip had been carved out of the, if you look at it on a Mercator map, shall I say, the bottom right-hand corner of the island. And immediately facing Columbangara, which I suppose is somewhere between 10 and 20 miles away. Columbangara looks just like Mount Fujiyama, transported to the Pacific and plunked into the sea, but without the snow on top. A perfectly, nearly circular, but perfectly conical island. Obviously an extinct volcano. And I think when we got onto Vela, Columbangara had been bypassed, and there was still a small Japanese unit on there. I think I think they had a seaplane or two, not much else. On the skyline to our slightly to the left of Columbangara was St. Isabel, where at that time headhunting and cannibalism was not entirely unknown, and we could just see the faintest shadow north again of Choiseul. And north again from that, of course, was Bougainville. The New Zealand 3rd Division had made the landing, and they were not too pleased with the Americans because they'd taken casualties as they went in from American troops coming in behind them, who had fired through them instead of over them. And this kind of thing was not at all not that unusual in the island campaigns, so that there was relationship between the Kiwis and the Yanks was always just on a nice balance. Because of it, of course, there were all the other things as well that upset the Kiwis, like the Yanks having big bases in New Zealand, and the Americans playing fast and loose with the New Zealand girls whilst the Kiwis were away. This is par for the course, though, in all wars, isn't it? We landed and made our way off the strip along a muddy track, and found our way to some sort of office where we were looked on more or less with amazement. Who the devil are you, and what do you want, and so on. On occasions like this, the system sometimes breaks down a bit. All the signals don't seem to have reached all the appropriate spots. Anyway, we were given a billet initially in, I suppose, a reception hut, and told what the score was with regard to the cookhouse and atabrin and salt tablets and all the other things. And eventually I met, I suppose, the engineer officer, US Marines, and he sorted out what we were supposed to be doing, and more or less gave us authority to get ourselves organised. And I asked for a site well clear of the cookhouse and all the funny burners that were being used, explaining to him that we wanted a site where we were upwind of any sources of contamination in the air, so that we could get the cleanest air possible. And he gave us a patch immediately over the quarry which had been used, where the coral had been carved out of the hillside to build up the strip. And when we asked what this area was called, we were told it's called Suicide Wood. When we asked later, we found out that it was called Suicide Wood because the white face of the quarry in the hillside made such a marvellous marker for the Japs that, of course, they came stonking in there. That's where the camp had been initially, and they'd come stonking into there and bombed and strafed it, and hence Suicide Wood. And I suppose it was something of a joke on this Bob's part to give it to us. As it happens, it didn't greatly matter, because of Japanese strikes, any serious Japanese strikes, we saw none at all, because by the time we got there, in US Navy terms, the island was, inverted commas, secure. And very secure indeed. The Japs on Kalambangara weren't about to raid us. They hadn't got the gear. And further north, on Bougainville, where the pressure was being applied for the next landings and so on, they were far too busy. And Rabaul, over the other way, was being kept quietly busy with all the bombing raids and so on that were being made from the islands. So that, as far as air raids went on, we saw nothing to speak of at all. Just one or two aircraft would flash past occasionally, and tacka-tacka-tacka-tacka-tacka, and gone, and that was it. But no serious strikes at all. There was an RAF mobile radar unit on the island, not very far from where we were, but rather curiously placed. It was down at low level, close to sea level, in a kind of closed valley. Truly, it was facing Bougainville and Choiseul and that area. It opened out in that direction, so that the general fan would cover the approach of the Japanese, but from behind there was a distinct screening by the hills, so that it was generally reckoned that the Japs were clued up to this and would make any strikes from the southwest, coming in over the hill, to be in the radar shadow, so that we had to watch out that way. But as I say, though, we saw very little. The chap running that section, the radar, was an RCAF Flight Louis, but I only met him once or twice. There was no reason for us to be involved. Typical setup with the artificial ground base of chicken netting in a circle around the square hut on its turntable. A little way further up the coast, past Golden Beach, was what I suppose had been a planter's hut or somebody's house, typical ATAP house on poles, quite large, and this had been taken over by the New Zealand Church Army Bod, who'd gone in with the landings. I gather that he'd gone in with the troops, and before the beach was cleared, he had a brew up going on the beach and was dishing out mugs of tea to the lads who as they landed. Which I also heard was fairly typical of these buds. Well, we made our number with him, and he was pleased to see us, and a few more, you know, the Kiwis who were with me and so on. And we mentioned that we got a bit fed up of this eternal coffee with the Yanks, and could he help us? And, oh, yes, he could help us. He gave us a biscuit tin full of tea, so that we could brew up and make our own tea. And also a great dollop of yellow acid drop type sweets, which seemed to be the staple sweet ration in the islands. I never saw anything else. But anyway, great dollops of these. And packs and packs and packs of some yellow sugary crystals, like the rather like the kali crystals that we used to get as kids, but not fizzy. And these you dolloped into the water to kill the taste of the chlorine. It made a kind of lemony orange drink. But when you consider that this was being used in the American field kit, where the drinking container is aluminium, yeah, it was rather like putting your lips to a battery every time you took a drink. The cold raw aluminium and the acid stuff. Yeah. Anyway, that got us set up. So what we had now to do was to establish our campsite. An American, US Navy petty officer had been allocated to the unit, and some US Navy personnel from the Aradid. And it was to be our job to train these bods to run the plant and then hand over to them, and we'd be sent back to New Zealand. And the petty officer first, Joe Granone, an Italian-American, very capable, as many of the Americans were, with internal combustion, motor transport and so on. Offhand, I forget what his trade was. I think he was a petty officer artificer of some sort. And I think he'd been fed up with being aboard Aradid, because I suppose he was a little bit out of his trade, in a way, aboard the ship. Anyway, Americans, how many did we have? One, two, three, four. Either four or six American gobs. One of them, I remember, Sabu Martesian, was, I think, Armenian in parentage, and he told us his sad story of how his mother had dumped him in a trash can in Chicago, and he'd been found there as a baby, bawling his head off in a trash can. His beginnings had certainly marked him, because he was probably the most terrified bud I ever came across. I can remember one morning being wakened by an eldritch screech. I've never heard any human being screech so loudly. The American mosquito nets were unlike ours in that they were only about 18 inches tall, so that the canes you stuck into the holes in the corners of the camp cots were quite short, and when you were inside that mozzie net, an American net, you could reach the top quite easily. And Sabu had wakened up one morning and found lying on the top of his net a snake. And the fact that there were no poisonous snakes on Vella La Vella was nothing to do with it. You couldn't persuade him that snakes couldn't be that there were snakes that were not poisonous. And he just let go of this fearsome yell, and when we got into his tent, he was lying there absolutely paralysed and grey in the face and bloodless. God, he was frightened. And it was a little brown snake about 15 inches long. We didn't even have the heart to kill it. We just picked it up and chucked it into the bush. And he was mentally, he wasn't very bright here. I mean, I think he'd been shuffled off onto us to get him off the ship, because he was one of those people who always get posted when someone asks for so many bodies, and they say, get rid of so-and-so, and we've got him. He hadn't a clue about engines and, running an engine and whatnot. And I think what he eventually learned about running an oxygen plant was probably less than 50% of what he needed to know, much less. He knew what certain things did and did them, but I really wouldn't have ever wanted him running the oxygen separator or doing the tests for purity in the trailer. You could leave him on watch running the compressors, because it was a fairly simple routine, and he could stand in there and blow the drain valves at the correct time and that kind of thing, go through a routine, but strictly, in RAF terms, an ACHGD, strictly non-technical. Anyway, Joe Granone, armed with one or two goodies which we acquired from here and there, went round seeking people in positions of power with whom he could negotiate. We quite quickly discovered that it was no good having authority to do this or do that. In the American Marines and the American Navy, I suppose it applies in other services too, you also have to oil the wheels, grease the palms of the bods who control the things that you need in order to be able to do it. We needed a bulldozer in order to scrape a standing place for our trucks. If we were going to be there in a length of time, we didn't want to be working in mud, so we wanted the top soil scraped off down to the coral, and we might as well have it scraped level whilst we were at it. And since trucks were going to be coming up to us bringing empty oxygen bottles and taking away full ones, we wanted a decent approach as well. So we needed a bit of dozing done, and by the judicious application of, packs of cement and packs of cigarettes other briberies and whatnot, Joe fixed up with some other petty officer to divert the dozer from whatever it was doing to come and do the job for us. Right. Campsite graded and cleaned up, whatnot, and we're feeling pretty good about that. That's done. Well, the next thing we decided we wanted was some lumber. We made a kind of boardwalk alongside the two plant. We set the two plant up head to tail, so that in effect there's truck trailer in one line, and right alongside that, when the side flaps were down, we decided to build a timber boardwalk at the height of oil drums, so that we could unload trucks of their oxygen bottles by simply rolling them off the truck and onto our platform, and load the full bottles on without any lifting and heaving and roaming about. And the side flaps on the plant also open from the top to provide a shelter, and we continued that using the doing this right along the left hand side of the vehicles, and use the canvas from the right hand side annexes to complete the shelter all the way along, so that when the daily rains came along, we were in shelter the whole time. We could work in the dry in decent comfort, as I say. So we needed some timber for that, and that required another bit of judicious dealing with the CB sawmill. Grease the appropriate palms with whatever. I didn't ask how Joe achieved this. It wasn't any part of my business. As long as he got it, I was delighted. And so we got a lot of rough sawn timber, some of which today, I imagine, would fetch a tidy price in the timber yards of the world. It's quite elegant material. And we built this up using oil drums with one end cut out and filled with coral to make a good pillar, and set the whole thing up. Poles stuck into these drums and bedded round with coral provided the supports for our roof. And a set of pyramidal tents, I think we had three of them. And there we are, we've got our campsite organised, and now I can get down to training this American crew, to run the plant. The first problem we come across is that we've been working 8 hours on and 16 off on the plant, which was the standard REF working scheme, and they're used to working 4 hours on and 8 hours off. Well, I suggested that whilst we were training, since we were used to the 8 hours on, 16 off, we'd train them under that scheme, and then when they came to do some running themselves, they could work their own watches. So we tried that, and curiously, it caused them no end of bother. They were so used to working 4 on, 8 off ship watches that they couldn't settle down to the 8 on, 16 off. They found 8 hours too hard going. They couldn't concentrate, they couldn't keep at it for 8 hours on the go. However, we slogged away trying to get the technicalities over to them. Big problem, of course, is that they were totally lacking in any knowledge of science or physics. And separating oxygen from the atmosphere using the Claude systems does require you to have a little bit of knowledge. of this. And anyway, we, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks at this. And then I decided that with the New Zealand, with my New Zealanders working with them, with a New Zealander on shift, with an American, two chaps on shift at a time, one running the compressors and one running the separators, that we could start trying some production. So I asked that they start supplying us with empty bottles. Well, the American oxygen bottles and the American oxygen system, as I'd discovered on Guadalcanal, was quite different from the RAF one. The RAF, for which these system for which these plants were intended, used long storage bottles, about 8 feet long, filled to 3,600 pounds square inch pressure. And from those storage bottles, the oxygen was transferred into the aircraft bottles by means of a regulator. In other words, when the storage bottle dropped to 1,800 pounds, you sent it back to be refilled. It was never allowed to be emptied. Once initially filled with oxygen, it remained filled with oxygen under pressure for the rest of its life, and if at any time it was emptied, then it had to be either sent fitted up onto a proper plant where it could be dried out thoroughly and made certainly free of moisture before it could be refilled again. And the refilling required it to be filled and flushed with oxygen several times to establish a base fill of clean oxygen. Quite complicated. The purity figures we were allowed, I think our minimum purity, if I remember correctly, was about 98.5%. The amount of moisture allowed in the oxygen we bottled was, I think, 0.003 grams per cubic meter. CO2, effectively nil. The CO2 showed up in the oxygen. If you tapped off some liquid oxygen from the separator into a Dewar flask, or Dewar flask, it came out, you get a clear pale blue liquid, and any CO2 present would show up as tiny white flakes of solid CO2 in the liquid oxygen, because of the temperature of the oxygen being so much colder than that required for CO2. For the basic purity of the thing, we had a chemical test set which used concentrated ammonia in a burette and flask, a levelling flask, so that the whole system, when full, could be connected to the gas supply from the separator, and the oxygen could be blown into the burette and a measured 100 cc's taken off. The liquid which had been in the